talking about viruses. And so you're going to need handout A, 17A. If you don't have the handouts, there are two today. Please get them both. The excuse for bringing up viruses is that viruses can act as agents to carry bacterial DNA around and promote bacterial sex through transduction. So I want to explain why that happens, but also this is an excuse to talk about virus reproduction in general. So, what is a virus anyway? A virus is an inert structure. It consists of a protein shell and nucleic acid inside, which acts as its genetic material. Now, this can actually be DNA or RNA, single-stranded or double-stranded, and depending on which, there's a slight variation in the cycle. We're going to largely stick to cases where you have double-stranded DNA. Now, this particle is inert because it has no enzymes for making ATP. It has no way of getting energy. And it has no ribosomes, etc. It has no translation machine. So even if it has genetic information, it cannot express it. So it is inert. You can actually crystallize virus particles and put them in a bottle and let them sit in the shelf indefinitely. However, viruses, as you know, are intracellular parasites. So they can, once they get inside a cell, this genetic information can then be expressed and used to make more virus. So how does that work? This is the virus, and this is its target cell, and since we're talking prokaryotes, this would be the target cell. Now, in order for this virus to attach to this cell, there has to be a match, as with an enzyme and a substrate, between the surface of the cell and the surface of the virus. And if there is a match, then the virus will stick to the cell. You get attachment, as shown in your next picture. Now, this doesn't do anything to the cell unless the genetic information gets inside the cell. Some viruses, the entire virus enters. But in many bacterial viruses, it's only the nucleic acid which gets inside and the protein stays outside. And this was shown in a very famous experiment, which in fact indicated that it was the DNA that took over the cell and subverted it to make virus and not the protein. And therefore, DNA is the genetic material. So here we have the cell. Remember, all these lines are double-stranded DNA. Here we have the bacterial genome and the virus genome. Now, how does the virus take over the factory, so to speak, and cause it to make more virus? The trick to that is that the viral DNA has to be transcribed and translated. It has to be expressed. So you can use the viral genetic information to make viral materials. And that's what happens next, that the virus is used as genetic information to make messenger RNA, and then that messenger RNA is used to make proteins. Now, these are proteins that will be used either in the construction of new virus or to help promote the reproduction of the virus at the expense of the host. So these are the viral proteins. We didn't draw the message in here, but we would have had to have messenger RNA in order to make the proteins. Now, from the virus's point of view, the whole point of this is to make more virus. So to make more virus particles, not only are we going to need the protein to assemble the shell, but we're going to need more copies of the nucleic acid. So using the available enzymes of the host and the virus, the DNA is also replicated to make many copies. Now, how do cells go about making more? One cell makes two, two cells make four, so four cells make eight. We started with one virus particle. Did one make two and two make four? Notice there are no virus particles. Viruses reproduce in a kind of assembly line mechanism. They come apart, they instruct the construction of spare parts in large amounts, and then at a later date, they put together the spare parts. So the next step, after you have all the pieces, is assembly. And so inside the cell, virus particles now, the protein surrounds the DNA and you form particles. Now, this is a kind of self-assembly process. The information to do this is embedded in the primary structures of the protein and the DNA. Now, have you ever heard of another large structure that can, so to speak, self-assemble? What about ribosomes? This is a similar business, something that has many parts, and if you mix the parts together, you get the reconstituted whole. Now, the importance of this is this means that in a test tube, we can mix DNA pieces and viral proteins and assemble viral particles, or what look like viral particles, that have whatever DNA we want inside. And these are often used in genetic information. In genetic engineering, we use these modified viruses. Okay, now what we're talking about here is what is called the lytic cycle. It comes from the term lysis, to break open. Because once the cell is packed with virus particles, it breaks open. Either because of an enzyme made by the virus that chews up the wall, or just by the cell is so packed that it bursts. So the cell breaks open and releases virus particles. So this is lysis. Now, why is this called a cycle? Because these particles can now go find new cells to infect and start the cycle all over again. So this is a cycle. Now, it's because it's a cycle that it was discovered. There was a scientist who was working with bacteria, and he left a petri dish on his lab bench, and it was covered with a solid lawn of bacteria. And when he came back in the morning, there were holes in it. There were holes in the solid lawn of bacteria. And he said, something's eating my bacteria. Something has landed in here and eaten a hole. And he named it bacteriophage, or bacteriophage, for bacteria eater. So bacterial viruses are known as bacteriophages, or phage for short. Now, this is not a synonym for virus. This is a synonym for bacterial virus. Now, how do we get these so-called, how do we get these holes? What happens is that one bacterial virus particle lands, it infects a single cell, breaks that cell open, lyses the cell, and releases more particles. They infect the surrounding cells and lyse them, and they affect the surrounding cells. So the virus gradually eats a hole in the lawn of bacteria. Now, the viruses floating around in this hole are all constitute a clone. They're all the descendants of a single virus that landed on a single bacterium. And these holes are called plaques. Now, a way a plaque is equivalent to a bacterial colony, except it's a hole instead of a lump. When you have a plain petri dish and you put bacteria on it, each bacterium makes one and then two and then four and then eight, and then it forms a colony or a lump. So this colony is the descendant of one bacterium, a clone. Similarly, the viruses in this plaque are the descendant of one virus. They are a clone. But instead of making a lump, they eat a hole in the lawn of bacteria. What if you put a plain virus particle down on a plain petri dish with agar in it? Can a virus do anything by itself? No, it can't. It has to land on a living cell, take over the cell. Now, the excuse for bringing all of this up was that viruses can sometimes carry bacterial DNA by mistake. Now, the argument here is that, go back and look at this business of assembly line reproduction. That put this pink on to distinguish the bacterial DNA from the viral DNA. Some viruses produce enzymes that cut up the bacterial DNA. Now, if I cut up the bacterial DNA to pieces, it means that in this cell, there are fragments of DNA. Some of them are bacterial, and some of them are viral. So that when the protein assembles around a fragment, once in a while, the viral protein assembles around a fragment of bacterial DNA. So what we have here looks like a virus from the outside, but inside the DNA is really bacterial DNA and not viral DNA. And one person named this a phony phage, which I think is a good name for it. It's a virus, it looks like a virus. Now what will happen when that cell lyses? When that cell lyses, we will release the phony phage. What if the phony phage bumps into a bacterial cell? It will attach to the cell, and it will deliver its DNA. But that's now bacterial DNA. So the picture will look like this. Does that picture look familiar? This is the bottom of 16A from last time. This is what you get from transformation. This is what you get from conjugation. You have the endogenous bacterial chromosome and a fragment. But in this case, the fragment was delivered by a virus, so this is what we mean by transduction. And now integration can or cannot happen due to crossing over, recombination. If the fragment is integrated, it will now change the genetic makeup of the bacterium, just as transformation can. Now, maybe this is a little easier. One part of this is easier to see if we have a model. We said that the outside of the virus the mic went off for a minute, yeah. That the outside of the virus has to match the outside of the cell. Well, many bacterial viruses look something like this. They have a head, and the DNA is in the head, and then they have a sort of stalk with a tail. And it's in these cases, it's the tail that attaches to the surface of the cell. So I have a little mock cell surface here. It's come apart. So this would be a little patch of cell surface here. The critical point here is that on the surface of the cell, there is a structure which is complementary to a structure on the surface of the virus. So if the surface is like that, then the virus is able to attach and now inject its DNA into the cell. If there is no matching structure on the cell, if the cell surface were entirely smooth, or if the bumps were a different shape, the virus could not attach and it could not infect. It is the complementary match between the shell and the cell surface that determines in many cases the specificity of infection. What kind of cell this virus will attack successfully. An example of this in humans is that poliovirus and the cold virus, the common cold virus, are very similar. Clearly, you would rather have a common cold. The difference is that the surface of the cold virus sticks to the cells in your nose, and the surface of the poliovirus sticks to the cells of your nerves and your brain. And therefore, it infects those cells and causes much more damage. Put my virus away. Now, there's only one more thing I wanted to mention about viruses. We talked last time about bacterial sex. There's also viral sex. Remember what sex means biologically? It means the reshuffling of genetic material. So normally we think of a bacterium and a virus, and the virus material, genetic material, gets into the cell, and then it makes many copies of itself. What if the cell were infected simultaneously by two similar viruses? Let's suppose, for example, they're variants of the same thing. Well, I'll write one wiggly to make it clearly different. When those two DNAs get inside, the infected cell is going to make multiple copies of each DNA. And those DNAs are going to get packed into shells, etc. But there's also a possibility here for recombination. There can be crossing over between the two different kinds of DNA. If these two DNAs are close enough, if they are homologous, we can have crossing over and recombination. Now, this is sort of a group sex situation. Any one of these chromosomes can cross over with any one of the others. Now, the times when this is really interesting is if these are both, these two viruses are variants of the same virus. They are mutants of the same virus. So now they get inside and you make many copies of each one. Now what's going to happen? By now we know that recombination can occur. Will I ever get out of this a good progeny virus? I will, except in one situation. What has to be true to get good virus out of here? The two mutations have to be different. They have to be non-overlapping. So by cutting and rejoining, I can reconstitute a good progeny virus. So this, if I get good progeny back, it means the mutations were in different spots. But remember that business about complementation that we talked about last time. Let's now consider our two mutants. Now, when we talk about complementation, we're ignoring recombination. Suppose there is no recombination at all. Can I get a normal infection here? Can I make all the proteins I need? Yes, because what I've implied from this picture is that mutant 1 is in one gene and mutant 2 is in another. So I've got a good copy of gene 1, a good copy of gene 2, and this cell will get through infection in a normal way. But when this cell goes to make progeny virus, will they be good or bad? They're going to be bad because one or the other mutant is going to get encapsulated. Now, is there a time when I wouldn't get a normal infection? These two mutations have complemented. Why might they not complement? Well, if the situation were something like this, if in fact both mutations were in the same gene, then in fact I can make good protein 1, but I can't make any good protein 2, and I won't have a normal infection. The mutations will not complement. Now, the other thing that I should mention about complementation and recombination is in the case of complementation, when I put the two complementary mutants together, how often do I get back function? If these two are in the same cell, will I get function back? Yeah, every time. But when I have two mutants that are different in the same cell, how often will I get a recombinant good chromosome? Every time? And this time the answer is no. Because I have to have crossing over in the right place. If I have two different mutations, I have to have crossing over in this area between them in order to get a good chromosome out of this. And crossing over is fairly common, but crossing over in any particular area is usually fairly rare. And so I won't get a good one every single time. Only once in a while will I get a crossover in the right place and get myself a good recombinant. Now, we will talk later, when we talk about formal genetics, about the relationship between the size of this interval and the frequency of crossing over or recombination. Let's just say that the smaller the interval, the less the chance that you will get yourself a good recombinant. So as this distance goes down, the number of recombinants goes down. Now I realize there is one more thing about viruses we forgot. On your handout of the lytic cycle, there's actually another variation. Once you get to this stage where you have a chromosome, bacterial chromosome, you look on your handout, and a viral chromosome, one possibility is that the virus expresses itself, makes more virus, destroys and lyses the cell. That's the lytic cycle. But another possibility in some cases is that the virus can lie dormant and you get what is called the lysogenic state or the lysogenic cycle. And in that case, the virus genome has become part of the bacterial chromosome and it can just lie there for a long period. Now this cell is said to be lysogenic because the process is reversible. And if this cell is triggered to recombine so that the virus now separates from the chromosome, we can enter the lytic cycle. This cell is dormant, but it has the virus DNA and is therefore ready to enter the lytic cycle at any time. Now, how do you get a virus to be part of the big chromosome? This is exactly the same idea as how you get an F factor integrated into a bacterial chromosome. That inside the cell, the viral chromosome is usually a circle. The bacterial chromosome is usually a circle. And therefore, all you need is one cut and rejoin event to generate one big circle. And this means that every time the bacterial DNA is replicated, the viral DNA will be as well. And the virus can just get a free ride and be carried along until such time as it in fact reverses the process, becomes independent, and can enter the lytic cycle. Now the one thing I want to mention more is that what keeps the virus dormant? What keeps it from being transcribed, making protein, RNA, and taking over the cell? The answer is a repressor protein. That the virus actually makes its own repressor protein, and that sits on this extra piece of DNA and keeps it silent. And this protein, if it is destroyed, stops its function, and the virus enters the lytic cycle. So the same sort of mechanism is responsible for lysogeny, dormant viruses, induction and repression. The big difference is that in this case, the repressor protein is not an allosteric protein, but a protein which is permanently in the repressor form, in the rectangle form. So how can you turn on this operon, so to speak? The only way is to get rid of or to destroy the repressor. Now, the cycle we have described here is a standard cycle for a virus in which the genetic information is double-stranded DNA. If the genetic information is single-stranded DNA or RNA, then additional steps are required. And one of the most famous is what is required if the virus genetic material is RNA. In the class of viruses that are called retroviruses. Now, not all RNA viruses are like this, but what RNA retroviruses are like is that the virus carries RNA, and when it enters a cell, that RNA is now inside the cell. But what is meant by retro here is that instead of using DNA to make RNA, in this special case, we use RNA to make DNA. So this RNA is used as a template to make DNA. So you get a partner, And then what happens is, using other enzymes, you degrade the original RNA part and make a complement to the DNA, so you end up with double-stranded, what is called cDNA, or complementary DNA, DNA which was made off an RNA template. And this process requires a special viral enzyme, which is called reverse transcriptase. It does the opposite of RNA polymerase. RNA polymerase takes a DNA template and makes RNA. This takes an RNA template and makes DNA. And the people who discovered this, Temin in Baltimore, received the Nobel Prize for it. Now, this is not just a curiosity. It's of enormous importance in viral reproduction, to our dismay. But the other thing about this enzyme is, this particular enzyme is a very important lab tool. Because if you have RNA, you can use that RNA to make the DNA equivalent and the DNA complement. And that turns out to be very, very useful. And we will meet examples later of using RNA to make cDNA, that is, DNA from the RNA template in a laboratory. Now, in terms of infection, the most famous retrovirus that you've heard of is HIV. HIV is not HIV virus. And the ATM is not an ATM machine. This stands for human immunodeficiency virus. And HIV is a retrovirus, and it works in this way, that it carries RNA in. The RNA makes a DNA copy, and then the DNA integrates into the chromosome. That's what happens in retroviruses, is this DNA becomes a dormant part of the total DNA of the cell. This DNA is integrated into the chromosomal DNA and then is passed on from cell to cell during cell division. And it remains dormant for a long time until later on when it starts to replicate. The situation is actually a little different in higher organisms. In higher organisms, the dormant virus can cause the production of small amounts of virus particles without killing the cell. If you're interested in how HIV works, both of your textbooks, I think, have extensive descriptions of the life cycle of HIV. But for now, we're going to stick to bacterial viruses and just consider this issue important, because from retroviruses, we have got the important lab tool, reverse transcriptase. Now, I want to go on and talk about something quite different, which is restriction enzymes. So let me ask first what questions people have about this virus business.
Two questions. So first would be the receptor site. Is it always the receptor site, or could they use membrane channels to inject their DNA/RNA?
His question is, do you need a receptor site on the surface, or can you use a membrane channel? I think you always use a receptor, but the point here is that a virus must bind to a protein on the surface of the cell. Now, the question is, why do the cells have those proteins? They don't have them in order to bind viruses. They're always proteins that do something else. But the virus has evolved to bind that particular protein, and it could be a channel, but it's usually a receptor. What's your other question?
The second one's about just our retroviruses. So is the reason that HIV and other retroviruses, they use a lot more, is because they use RNA as their kind of their just base material, or?
His question is RNA, is HIV more variable than some because it has RNA as genetic material? And I think that is one of the reasons, yes. Most RNA viruses are more mutable, that is, they have a higher error rate in reproduction than DNA viruses do. Yes?
When you're talking about the repressor on the virus, from what it sounds like, it's that's not the usual case. The usual case is that it's not repressed and it reproduces. And then why would you sometimes have it where the repressor is permanently keeping it from...
Her question is, why would you take this path instead of this one? Well, it appears to depend in large part on the conditions of growth of the bacterial cell. If the bacterium is healthy, this path is favored. Because if the bacterium is healthy, getting a free ride is a good deal. If the bacterium is not healthy, then this path appears to be favored. Now, there is some random chance in it, but the favoring has to do with the conditions of the growth. Because if the virus is not, if the bacterium is not doing well, then hitching a ride is not a good deal, and it's better to destroy the viruses, the cell, and reproduce the virus. Now, of course, the virus doesn't know what it's doing. It doesn't plan. But the point is that the rats that didn't leave the sinking ship are not around to reproduce.
Just to follow, are you saying that the healthier ones, the healthier cells would then be...
In healthier cells, generally, the virus becomes lysogenic. Yes?
Where do the enzymes come from that cleave the actual bacteria DNA?
Where do the enzymes come from that cleave the bacterial DNA? They are coded by the virus. One of the reasons for drawing two symbols here is to imply that there are two kinds of proteins. One are the structural proteins of the virus, which will be needed to make the coat. And then there are additional enzymes, many in some viruses, a few in others, which enable virus reproduction at the expense of the host. Okay. So now I want to talk about restriction enzymes. And they were actually discovered from studying virus reproduction. And that's one of the reasons for talking about them now. Restriction enzymes allow us to manipulate DNA and do all of recombinant DNA research and genetic engineering. They are a marvelous and wonderful thing. And they were discovered completely by accident. They are the scientists' best example of serendipity and why you should allow scientists to follow their curiosity and give them grant money. Because you never know what will happen. This does not mean you should pay them to sit and fool around in the lab, but that they should be paid to follow lines of investigation which don't have an obvious payoff. In this case, people who are studying virus reproduction discovered a phenomenon called restriction, which seemed to be of no value to anybody, but it was very peculiar. And so they followed it up and found something very interesting. So let me explain what the phenomenon is and what it's led to. So first I have to find my good eraser. Where do I put it? Here it is. Okay. People were following the reproduction of a particular type of virus. And they discovered that if you take this virus, virus V, and you infect bacteria type A, you got lots of progeny virus. No problem. But if you took the same virus and you put it into a different bacterium, what we'll call type B, you got very few progeny. So people said that growth was of this virus was restricted on bacterium type B. That's where the name restriction comes from. Growth is restricted on bacterium type B. But now, consider these very few progeny who managed to squeak by. If you take them and you infect bacterium type B, what do you expect to happen? It's sort of the same thing all over again, but it doesn't. These bacteria, these viruses now, that squeak through, reproduce beautifully on bacterium B. They are no longer restricted. Once a virus squeaks through, it has escaped restriction permanently, and its progeny are no longer restricted. Now, the thing that's odd here is what seems like the obvious thing is you selected a few mutants which have some variation in their DNA, and now they're able to reproduce fine on B. But when you examine the DNA of the virus, the DNA of the virus that escaped restriction has exactly the same sequence as the virus that was restricted. The virus in all of these cases has exactly the same DNA sequence. It hasn't been changed. And that's what mystified people. What's different about this virus that has escaped restriction if its DNA sequence is the same? Well, the answer to this seems to be that the DNA sequence is the same, but the DNA has been modified. And that's the secret behind this. It turns out that bacteria have two sets of enzymes. One set is called restriction enzymes, and these break down DNA. The others are called modification enzymes, and these add methyl groups to bases in the DNA. So they don't change the A, G, C, and T at all, but they add methyl to some of the bases. Now, what's happening is, who has the restriction enzyme? It's bacteria A do not. Bacteria A has no enzyme, restriction enzyme, so the virus reproduces fine. Bacteria B has the restriction enzyme. So when the virus gets into bacterium B, its DNA is chewed up. It doesn't reproduce. Why doesn't the bacterium's own DNA get chewed up? If this cell has a nuclease, which is what restriction enzymes are, they are endonucleases. If an endonuclease chews up one DNA, why doesn't it chew up another? We have to ask a little bit, what do we mean by an endonuclease? Until this time, people knew about lots of nucleases, enzymes that chew up DNA. But all of them cut the DNA at random. You present it with DNA, it just chops it up. These enzymes are special in that they cut at a specific site. It turns out that these bacteria, which were the first to be examined, which were kind of E. coli, had the enzyme, which is called ECHO-R1. And what it does is written on handout D. ECHO-R1 means E. coli restriction enzyme 1. And it cuts every time this particular sequence is found. I'm going to write it. It's not written this way on your handout, but it's the same thing. Any place this sequence is found in the DNA, what happens is a cut is made at equivalent points in the two strands. So this covalent bond is broken, the phosphodiester bond, and this covalent bond is broken. Now that means what's holding the two halves together? There's a long DNA down here, long DNA over there. What's holding the two halves together? Two hydrogen bonds, two hydrogen bonds, two hydrogen bonds, two hydrogen, that's it. Now, that will hold them together very temporarily, but if there's any agitation or time, these DNAs will fall apart. And so you will have one DNA like this and one DNA like that. So the DNAs fall apart. Now what happens is that bacteria B contains ECHO-R1. So when the virus DNA comes in, that enzyme chews up the DNA. Now, how is an endonuclease different from an exonuclease? We talked about 5', 3' exo and 3', 5' exo. An exonuclease chews from the end, from the outside exo. An endonuclease goes to the middle and cuts it in the middle. And this is the first enzyme known that is sequence specific and only cuts at this sequence. So why doesn't it cut up the bacterial DNA? The first thought was maybe this sequence was not found in the bacterial DNA. But it is. This sequence is found in the bacterial DNA, but it's not chewed up. And the reason is that in bacteria, this A and the equivalent one, these A's are modified. They have a methyl attached to them. So bacterium B has two things. It has a restriction enzyme that chews every time it sees the unmodified sequence, and it has an enzyme for modifying the sequence. And the modified sequence is resistant. Now, how does this work? Normally, in the bacterium, every time the sequence we're talking about occurs, it's been modified or methylated on both strands. So the bacterial DNA looks like this. What happens at DNA replication? The two strands come apart, and you make a new complement. Now, modification enzymes only modify DNA, which is hemimethylated, meaning it has a methyl on one side, meaning that if the DNA looks like this, no methyls, nothing happens. If the DNA is completely methylated already, nothing happens. But if the DNA is methylated on one side and not the other, and you have this specific sequence, then what will happen is the modification enzyme will add the missing methyl on the other side. Now, the significance of this is that this state of methylation then is inherited. Because every time the DNA is replicated, the modification enzymes fix it up again, and the pattern is inherited. This kind of modification is called an epigenetic effect. You haven't changed the DNA at all, but you've changed the state of the DNA by modifying it. This is a very hot area of research at the moment, because it's been discovered that there are enzymes that modify in higher organisms both the DNA and the proteins attached to it, and these modifications are inherited in exactly this kind of pattern. So it's thought that in higher organisms, these modifications change the expression of the genes. We don't worry about restriction enzymes in higher organisms, but we worry about whether this gene can be read out or not. And the state of modification apparently affects its ability to be read. And so a gene can be kept turned off by this kind of modification or kept turned on for many generations. So that's all I want to say about epigenetics, but it is currently a hot topic. Okay, so we understand the bacterium, why the bacterium is resistant to its own restriction enzymes. Because its DNA is modified, and every time it is replicated, the hemimodified DNA is completely modified again. But what about the virus? When the virus comes in, it looks like this. Its DNA looks like this, and usually the restriction enzyme chews it up. But once in a while, by accident, an occasional molecule of viral DNA gets modified. That's what happens to these escapees. They just happen to have DNA that accidentally got modified. But once your DNA is modified, what happens when it replicates? It gets modified again. So once you're a fully modified virus, you're immune to the enzyme. And you can reproduce just fine. We now understand that different bacteria make different restriction enzymes, so that we now have a whole collection of restriction enzymes which break at different points and in different ways, which are used as lab tools. In nature, it's clear that these enzymes are defenses by the bacterium against viruses. So if we came back to here, what we're saying is that bacterium A has neither modification nor restriction enzymes, and bacterium B has both. Now, let's take a closer look. Before we leave this, what's this modification business? We've actually met examples of modification before. For example, in transfer RNA, the A is turned into an I. In protein synthesis, after you make the protein, you sometimes cut off the methionine. It turns out that modification is a big deal. And it's even a bigger deal in eukaryotes. And we'll talk about it more next semester. And some modifications are actually reversible and are used to control function. Like in higher organisms, you can put the methyls on and take them off in association with turning on and off genes. So this modification business is big, and we'll find more examples as we go. But for now, what I want to do is look a little more closely at the various restriction enzymes. Do they have any properties in common? So you want to look back then at D again, at this little table of restriction enzymes. It starts with this one, with ECHO-R1. Now, the names that these things have to do with the bacterium in which they were found and which one they were. HAY3 comes from Haemophilus aegypti, etc. And some of these have quite imaginative names. ECHO-R1 is typical of all of them in one respect. All of the sequences which you see are palindromes. A palindrome is a sequence that reads the same forwards and backwards. And all restriction sites are either exact palindromes or very close to it. An English palindrome is Madam, I'm Adam. Or a man, a plan, a canal, Panama. Or, this is attributed to Napoleon, but I'm sure he never said it, Able was I ere I saw Elba. So these are the same backwards and forwards. Well, so is this. If you think of it in base pairs, with the 5 prime on the top, it's GCATAT, or it's GCATAT. Or it's GAATTC, GAATTC. Another way to see it is if I took this out and rotated it 180 degrees, it would be exactly the same. So any way you look at it, this is a palindrome. And all the ones here are palindromes. You notice, though, that some are longer and some are shorter. This is a so-called six-cutter. It recognizes a six-base sequence. There are 2 four-cutters here and 2 six-cutters here. The shortest known is a four-cutter. Some restriction enzymes cut very long sequences. Now, if you use a restriction enzyme that cuts a very long sequence, that sequence won't occur very often, and you'll get bigger pieces of DNA. If you use an enzyme that cuts at a short sequence, that sequence will be found in the DNA more often, and you will get many pieces. So as lab tools, these are useful in different ways. Now, the other important thing to notice is how these enzymes cut. 2 of the examples here cut in a staggered way, ECHO-R1 and HINDY3. The cuts are always at equivalent spots on the 2 strands, and in here, the 2 cuts are not right opposite each other. But if you look at HAY3, which cuts GGCC, then it cuts like this, right across. Now, the difference is, if you have a staggered cut, when you take the 2 apart, the 2 halves apart, this has a single-stranded overhanging end, and the other side has a single-stranded overhanging end. These are called sticky ends because if you mix these molecules, they will temporarily stick together. And by adding ligase, you can put it all back together again and make a covalent molecule. On the other hand, if they cut right opposite each other, then the ends you get have no single-stranded overhang, and these are called blunt ends. Some enzymes give you blunt enzyme ends, some give you sticky ends. Sticky ends are used more often in genetic engineering, but both are useful. Now, we maybe should look at a brief use at this point of sticky ends. Maybe I should say first, why are people so excited about restriction enzymes? Remember I said before this, all nucleases cut DNA at random. Before we discovered restriction enzymes, there was no way to cut DNA up into reproducible, manageable size pieces. Now we have it. We can cut all of our DNA molecules the same way from a certain source. We can get a fixed set of pieces. And that both allows genetic engineering, because we can cut pieces from different sources and stick them together, especially using the sticky end trick. And it also means that we can analyze DNA by cutting it up and seeing what kind of pieces do we get. So let's look very briefly at this joining business, and then we'll look at the other use. If you look at your handout again, but this time you want to look at B, we have here two examples of how you use sticky ends to put things together. So you see on the left here of B, where it says joining DNAs, we have two DNAs that have the same sequence in the middle. Now, the assumption from those pictures is that the two DNAs we've drawn have the same restriction site in the middle, but this part here is different from this, this part here is different from that. So these are different DNA molecules. They just have the same restriction site in the middle. So if we cut them with the same restriction enzymes, we're going to get the four pieces shown. We're going to get X and Z from that one, and we're going to get Y and Q from this one. Now, because the overlapping or overhanging ends are the same each time, it seems sort of obvious that not only can I put Y and Q back together again, or X and Z, but I could put, say, Y and Z together. Because this is the complement of this. The ends that stick out, this end and this end, are complementary. And so I can put these two together. They'll hold temporarily. I can add ligase, and then I can get a recombinant molecule that has the left end, the Y, stuck to the Z. So I have a question for you. Can you make Q stick to X or Z? And can Y go with X? I want you to look at it for a minute and see what you think. Not a bad idea to check with the person next to you to be sure you're in agreement as to how this works. So now I have a question for you. Can Q go with X?
Yes.
Can Q go with Z?
Yes.
Can Y go with X? I mean, yes. The answer is all of these are possible. Because, here I have a little Velcro here. Here is, suppose we took a DNA molecule and we cut it up. Or we took two DNA molecules and we cut them up. You notice everyone has CTTAA hanging off. CTTAA. Now, it seems pretty obvious that we can overlap the ends and put it back together again. And what we're saying is you'd have to have ligase to join and make a covalent bond. But you can do it this way, but you can also turn it over and do it, the way we did it originally, the Watson of this one and the Watson of that one ended up together. But because we can turn it around and over, we can actually do it this way too. So the Watson of one is linked to the Crick of the other. All the 5' and the 3' work out fine. It doesn't matter whether you do it that way or this way. It works equally well. Now, the picture on the right shows the significance of this. If you put a fragment like this into a cell, what happens to it? Either it gets integrated or it gets degraded. But what if you put a plasmid into a cell? The plasmid is replicated and passed on generation after generation. So if you want to add extra genes to a cell by genetic engineering, the best way to do it is often to add the genes you want, put them in a plasmid, and add the plasmid. So what if you have a plasmid, you cut the plasmid with the enzyme, and you open the plasmid once. That's shown in your picture. Then you take your fragment and cut it up with the same enzyme. So they have complementary sticky ends. So this time when you put it together, the plasmid recircularizes, but now your sequence is in it, as shown in the picture. Now in the picture, the plasmid is bigger. The two pieces aren't the same size. But basically now, your fragment has become part of a plasmid, and so because the plasmid has an origin of replication, this will be passed on generation after generation. Now there's one catch you should know about. How many ways can I do this? I can do it that way. The way I just did it. But because of the sticky end business, because of the sticky end business, I can actually turn everything over. And I can do it this way too. Now it makes a difference. Because if I do it one way, Crick is inside. And if I do it the other way, Watson's inside. Now if all I want to do is replicate the DNA, it doesn't make any difference. But if I want to read the genes here and get them transcribed, if the promoter is here, if I do it this way, Crick is the template, so to speak, and I do it this way, Watson's the template. So it makes a difference, and only half of the time will it be able to be read properly and to get you anything. So we have to keep that in mind when we think about genetic engineering. So what we'll do next time is we'll talk at length about how you put pieces together and how you fish out the piece you want, etc., etc. But I want to leave the joining business for now and just say that you can do it and you can make recombinant plasmids and you can get them into cells and get them to work. And I want to come back to the other use of restriction enzymes, which is for identifications, forensic purposes, prenatal diagnosis, etc. That is, for detecting differences between the DNA of one person or organism and of another. And these variations could be inherited because they're differences in the DNA. So to give you an example of what I'm talking about, you want to go back to D. And we want to look at the bottom. So on the top, we have here three versions of the DNA. Now, I've only shown one strand here because it's easier. We all know the DNA is double-stranded, and if I specify one strand, we know what's in the other. And we're saying that one person might have DNA like case one, another person might have two, and another person might have three. Now, the difference is, we've drawn in the middle here the sequence GAATTC. This is the sequence recognized by ECHO-R1. And we've got another one here and another one here. But in addition, we've got a sequence here which is GGATTC. This is very similar, but notice it's one base different. Now, if you took this piece of DNA and you exposed it to ECHO-R1, what would happen? It would get cut here, but ECHO-R1 doesn't recognize this sequence. It's different. It would get cut here, and it would get cut here. So what would I get? I would get a piece that goes from here to here, and a piece that goes from here to here. But suppose another person had inherited DNA that had a mutation in which this A was turned to a G. Otherwise, the DNA is exactly the same. If this DNA were cut up by ECHO-R1, what would happen? It would still be cut here. It would not be cut here anymore. But it would be cut here. Now, in this case, people say you've lost a restriction site. Does that mean we deleted it? There's no deletion in the DNA. What that means when they say you've lost a restriction site is you've changed the sequence sufficiently so the enzyme won't recognize it anymore. So in this case, one restriction site is no longer red, and so instead of getting two pieces, I think I better put this here. Instead of getting, well, I don't want an arrow because it's too confusing. That I'll just write it like this. So now this sequence is the one that's not recognized anymore, but this one is, and this one. But now, in the third case, I've considered another possibility, which starting from the original, I've left the three sites alone, but this one that has GG, I've changed to GA. And so now I have four recognizable restriction sites. So what am I going to get in pieces? What was I going to get the second time? If I cut up, I'm just going to get one piece. But how many pieces will I get this time? I'm going to get three. I'm going to get one, two, three. Now, how do you tell which case you have? That turns out to be easy. Because DNAs can be separated on gels, much the way proteins can. Now, you use different material for the gel. You use agarose instead of polyacrylamide, but doesn't make any significant difference. It's the same idea as that you have a gel, and you have electric field, and things migrate through the gel. There's a sieving effect of the gel, and a pull of the electric field. The big difference is, with proteins, you have to have add SDS to make everybody negative. Do you have to do that here? Everybody's negative already because of all those phosphates. I think that must be a dead spot. Well, it's off, right? Maybe the battery went. Let's see. Yep, that's what it looks like. Okay, well, since it's not that, since we only have about 10 more minutes, I'm going to just yell. Okay, rather than bother to change the batteries. But I'm not going to take off the recorder. Okay. So how can you tell these cases apart? You take the DNA from each case and run that DNA an electrophoretic gel. Now, to make it easy, I'm going to put in some distances. Let's suppose this is 10.5 kilobases. These are semi-realistic. And this one is 6. So how big is the whole thing? 16.5. Now for the 3, let's make it 5, 5, 5, and 6. So what are the gels going to look like? If I put the DNA in here and I turn on the juice, what's going to happen? What am I going to get in case one? I mean, case two. How many pieces?
One.
Just one. So it's going to look like this. What are cases one and three going to look like? So you try it. Try it. Just be sure you know. What are you going to get for one and for three? Where will the bands be? Now, maybe we should remind ourselves. This is the positive. Who goes faster, small or big?
Small,
small wiggles. So this is, moves further is smaller. So this is smaller versus larger. So what will the bands be approximately for one and for three? So wait about 20 seconds and then we'll try it. So how many bands will I get in one? And where will they be? Will any of them be up here? No, they're going to be down here because this is the biggest. So they're going to be smaller for it. And let's see, this will be 10.5. This will be 6. Now, what about 3? Well, 3 has 3. Where are they? Any up here? Any here? In fact, the biggest one is here, and then we have 2 smaller. Okay. Now, suppose I wanted to know which kind of DNA I had. Because one of them, one of those mutations causes a disease, say. I want to know which one I've got. So to do it here, what I did is I had to get that piece of the DNA. And then I had to cut it up and compare. Well, you don't want to do it that way. You want to take all of my DNA and figure out which have I got. If you take all of my DNA and cut it up with this enzyme and run it on a gel, what will the pattern look like? Take all my DNA, cut it up with a gel. Cut it up with an enzyme, run it on a gel. You're going to get pieces of all different sizes from all of my chromosomes, and you're going to be able to see absolutely nothing. So what you want to be able to do is to pick out the section, where are these pieces that came from there? And from that, you need a probe. Now, before I explain what a probe is, let me just say why I wrote RFLP up there. This difference from one person to another is a difference in the pieces you get when you cut up with a restriction enzyme. So this is called a restriction fragment length polymorphism. Polymorphism just means it's different from person to person. Or an RFLP. Now, you could get information about differences by PCR, but that gives you a different kind of information, and it requires that you have primers to the area of interest. This does not require primers. So what am I going to do? We have already explained the concept of a probe. A probe is a piece of DNA which is labeled in some way with radioactivity, fluorescence, or something, so that when it finds its complement, it will stick. So using a piece of, that is complementary to the section of interest, I can do this. Now, to explain what I'm talking about, you want to look at handout C. Handout C describes what is called a blot. Suppose you had DNA from 3 different people cut up with the same enzyme. So you take those pieces and you do gel electrophoresis. And as we've explained, from each sample, this is what you're going to get. This is total DNA. Now, remember that section that we draw out that had either, it had restriction sites here, and in case 1, it had a restriction site here. In case 2, this one was missing. In case 3, we had an additional one. We want to know, where is the DNA that came from here? Now, suppose we had single-stranded DNA that went from here to here. If we could denature all of these pieces, if we could cut out the DNA from here and denature it, we could add that probe and see, does it stick? We could slice the whole thing up and test each one at a time. Nobody wants to do that. In the old days, that's how you did it. But then Terry Southern thought up something called a blot, which is called a Southern blot in his honor. That what you basically do, as shown in this picture, is you take paper or a sheet of nitrocellulose and you put it next to the gel. And you put blotting paper on one side, and that draws the liquid out of the gel into the paper. And the DNA then sits on the paper in the same relative spot it was in the gel. And if you treat the paper properly, the DNA sticks to the paper and is denatured. So what you've got here is the piece of DNA that ran that far. It's stuck to the paper now, not in a gel, and it's denatured. So now what you can do is you can add the probe. So there's a piece of DNA stuck in there, stuck on the paper, but denatured. And now you have your probe, which has some kind of label on it, radioactive, fluorescent, whatever. And you ask, will they stick together? If they're complementary, they will in fact stick. If they're not, they won't. So you actually put the paper in solution with the probe floating in the solution, and you let the probe hybridize. So our probe here comes from this part of the DNA. So it will only stick to fragments that came from that part of the DNA. So if, let's say, this fragment came from that part of the DNA, it'll stick here. If this fragment came, it'll stick here, and so on. So what you do here is you add your probe, where it says P32 labeled cDNA or RNA. That's the kind of probe they're using in this example. And then you hybridize. And now you do something to and then you wash off unattached probe, and you detect where your probe is. Now, how are you going to find it? If your probe was radioactive, you put this paper up against a piece of film in a dark room. If your probe was fluorescent, you illuminate with light, the right level of light, and you see what shines. One way or another now, you find out where is your probe. And in this example, you got something like this. That means this piece was complementary to the probe, but none of the others. This piece, but none of the others. This piece, but none of the others. Now, this procedure is called a blot. This thing here. If you started with DNA, it's called a Southern blot, after Terry Southern. As a joke, if you started with RNA, it's called a Northern blot. And if you started with protein, it's called a Western blot. And there is no Eastern blot. Now, how would you use this in the case we're talking about to wrap it up? If we draw our cases again, this was case one. This was case two. And this was case three. If I had a probe that stuck to this piece, if I cut this DNA up, how many pieces would stick to the probe? Or how many pieces would the probe stick to? On the gel would be this piece, this piece, this piece, this piece. But the probe would only stick to this one. On the gel, if I were type 2, would be this piece, one. And here, there would be only one. So how would I know which case it was? Well, the size of the piece the probe would find would be this length, or the whole thing, or very short. But just to make it more complicated, suppose the probe is the whole length. Then in this case, the probe will stick to one piece. How many pieces will the probe stick to in case one? Zero, one, or two? I hear zero, I hear one, I hear two. Well, what has happened here is like this. My probe is like that, but my DNA pieces are separate. Will my probe stick to this one? Yeah. It'll have an end flopping off, but it'll stick. This piece will be somewhere else in the gel. Will the probe stick to it? Sure. This end will stick. It'll have an end flopping off, but it'll work. The probe doesn't have to be the same length as your target. It doesn't have to be shorter than your target. It can be longer than your target. But the pattern you get will depend both on how you cut up the DNA and the kind of probe that you use. And there are many samples in your problem book of all the permutations and combinations to be sure you got the idea. So you can find out which case you are, which is useful in pre-symptomatic and prenatal diagnosis and other cases. So next time we'll talk a little bit more about how you use all of this in genetic engineering. Thank you.